And it's really nice to be back in PI after such a long hiatus. I think maybe Bianca has heard some parts of this talk at least last month, but I will nevertheless repeat much of it. And this is work that's basically done with a couple of my students, as well as Steve Carlip and his son, Peter Carlip. So Steve and Peter Carlip. So here's the outline of my talk. I'll begin with discussing what we mean by the causal set partition function. And the question of entropy versus action is in the setting of the causal set partition function. And it has been known for a very long time that there's a very strong entropic contribution from a class of causal sets called Kleitman-Rothschild, as well as the Dharpo sets. And of course, the question is, how do these very highly entropic causal sets affect the path integral or the path sum of the causal set partition function? For this, of course, we need to know also the action and the correct action, or the discrete class of discrete actions we're interested in are the ones that are, you know, go over to the Einstein-Hilbert action in the continuum limit. And these are the so-called Benincasa-Dauker-Glaser discrete actions. And so this is the entropy versus action game that I'll be talking about today. And the result is that there is, in fact, a suppression of this entropy in a certain range of parameters. And this was first done for the simplest class of such posets, which is the bilayer posets, by Loomis and Carlip in 2017. And then with my students, we looked at the more general case, in particular, the most dominant ones, which are these three-layer posets. But we used a simplified action because that was just the first thing to do. It wasn't the full Einstein-Hilbert, discrete Einstein-Hilbert action. It was a modified version of it, a simplified version. And we found the same suppression. And more recently, what we've done is to show that, in fact, that calculation is the right one, because for this class of posets, the action, the link action, just using the links, reduces to the Einstein-Hilbert action. So the simplified action we used earlier is in fact enough in this asymptotic limit that we're interested in. And this is the recent work that we've done. And I'll end with some open questions, some speculations, and so on. Okay, so I'm just going to do cop out of a full-blown introduction to causal sets, because I fear that if I did that, I would spend the whole, half of the talk on that. So please feel free to ask questions if, some of this is not clear to you. But I just want to set out what the causal set paradigm is. It's motivated through, results in Lorentzian geometry. But basically, there are two pieces to it. One is that causal sets are the fine-grained structure of space-time. Causal sets are posets. They're acyclic, so they're a set with an order relation on them. That order relation is acyclic, which means there are no closed causal loops. It's transitive, which basically reflects the fact that, light cones are nested one inside the other. And it's also locally finite, which means that if I have a space-time volume, then it has only a finite number of space-time elements in it. That structure that you extract out is from any continuum space-time, which is causal, is a partially ordered set with these features, and that's what we call a causal set. And here are examples of causal sets, which are just NL. These are all, of course, finite element causal sets, and so they're also, therefore, locally finite. But also important in this causal set paradigm is what we mean by the continuum. So how, if I just had a theory of posets, how can I recognize one that looks like space-time? I need to have a map, And the map that we choose is the one that's inspired from these theorems in Lorentzian geometry, where the order corresponds, the causal ordering, or the ordering on the coset corresponds to the causal ordering in the space-time, but also that the number of elements that you have, so in other words, there are a finite number of space-time elements per unit volume, but in order to make that correspondence possible, one has to resort to a random lattice, and we use a Poisson process to extract, for example, a classical ensemble of causal sets out of any continuum space-time. And this is what the slide is saying, the second half of the slide is saying. And so on average, you have then a number to volume correspondence. Rho here is the density of sprinkling. So it's related to the rho to the minus one upon d is your fundamental cutoff scale, length scale. That's there. That is the input into this continuum approximation. So this is sort of the two main ingredients. And please ask me more questions if this paradigm isn't clear to you. Yeah, sure.
Yes. What if you made the cutoff much larger than the Poisson scale? The same theorems would hold, yes?
Yes.
So there's no reason why the cutoff couldn't be, say, the weak scale.
Yes, absolutely. So, the question is, so this is related to our notions of coarse graining and so on. So if you have, imagine sort of some fundamental scale, maybe it's a Planck scale, and we'll see that the Planck scale kind of pops out of the analysis that we have. But suppose it's some fundamental scale, which is something like the Planck scale or 100 times the Planck scale, who knows? And now you say, I want to now coarse grain out to another scale. That's still a causal set. And I can think about coarse graining, that fine grain causal set, to whatever scale I wish. And given the richness of possibilities between the weak, the unification scale and quantum gravity, there's a lot of physics that might be there, which is because of discreteness. So you can do that. At this kinematic level, it's just a parameter. Is it dynamically generated? Is that scale dynamically generated? Is a big question. And we'll see in this talk that it's at least, if you pick the right values, then you get the kind of large scale behavior that you want.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, thanks. Okay. So if I want to construct a dynamics for causal sets, there's multiple ways to go. And that's because we don't know the right way to do things, but we try different ways. And the first, which is what this talk is going to be about, is the most obvious thing to do, which is to construct the Lorentzian path sum. This is what you would do, say, in spin forms and CDTs. You have your structures that you want to sum over, and that's what we're doing here as well. So you have a path sum, and you fix for some finite n-element class of causal sets, and that sample space I'm going to call omega n. And I will basically look at it as n becomes larger and larger, and how does this partition function behave? And that's this first sort of set of things, this first class of dynamics is what today's talk is going to be about. But you can also look at state sum models where you actually do an analytic continuation and study the path sum by introducing a new parameter. And then, of course, there are what we think of as more fundamental kind of growth models, sequential growth models, where instead of the partition function, you're thinking about a decoherence function or a double path integral. And those are definitely things that are actively being researched. But today, I'm just going to focus on this particular class of dynamics. defined in terms of as the Lorentzian path sum. So as I said, you're summing over all possible causal sets, which are n element posets basically. And the action we want to use is the discrete Benincasa-Dauker action, because it's the one that in the continuum limit gives you the Einstein-Hilbert action. And I shouldn't say the one, because obviously there's an entire family of them. And you know what the discrete version of this is not unique. But it's nevertheless a class of, definitely a class of interesting actions that one can look at, which has the right continuum limit. And we can think of the large N really more or less like the thermodynamic limit. And that's a useful way to think about it. So what is this action? This discrete Einstein-Hilbert action is basically found by Benincasa-Dauker and Glaser. So we call them the Benincasa-Dauker-Glaser actions. And what's very interesting about them is that you've got the Einstein-Hilbert action, and the discrete version reduces to counting. It reduces to counting in this causal set, you know, in this pore set. You count, say, the number of nearest neighbors. So nearest neighbors, I mean, things which have no other intervening element between them. So the most fundamental, or the nearest neighbors to any given point, you count all such links. Then you count, so that's this guy here. And then you count all intervals. And by an interval, I mean that, you know, the future of this and the past of that element contains just this one point, okay? And similarly, the future of this and the past of this contains two points, either like this or like this. And so you're counting just all of these intervals, and with this almost magical way of putting them together, and I say magical because it's not, we really don't have a clear understanding of why, for example, in four dimensions, you need a minimum of, up to N3, that is three element intervals. We don't have a systematic way of understanding it, but nevertheless, this is a class that works. It has the right limits. It gives you the Einstein-Hilbert action. So this is a class of actions that we'll be looking at. And what's important here is that apart from the links, you have all of these other things that enter into the action. If you look at the four-dimensional action, then you have all of these terms here. And one has to basically count. If you want to calculate the action, you'll have to count all of these objects, okay? Okay, just a word here about discrete covariance. And in a causal set, it's just essentially label invariance. In other words, suppose I did start with a space of all possible labeled causal sets, and that means at every point I give it a label, then of course I can relabel it, and I would want to consider that a gauge. So I would think of that relabeling as a gauge, and that would generate for me a sort of gauge group, if you like. Okay, and this is what discrete covariance looks like for the causal set. And so on the space of label causal sets, you're going to have orbits generated by these relabelings. So you start with one causal set, look at all the possible relabelings of it. And of course, if you had, you know, quote unquote, a generic causal set, then you have n factorial possible labelings. But you can also have automorphisms. And these automorphisms, are basically, ways when you swap things, they don't really change the labeled object either. So for example, if I have this, I hope you can see this, I hope it's clear. If I take this whole set and I swap it with this whole set in the following way, that I swap these two, and these two, then what I have is an automorphism. It doesn't change even the labeled causal set. So it's not quite that all the orbits are n factorial in size, or the number of elements in that orbit is n factorial. You also have this complicated question of automorphisms. But for us, and this is where I'm sort of already giving a warning that we will be talking alternately about just, you know, label causal sets. But the worst kind of overcounting that one has is n factorial. Okay. And that is going to be subleading for our analysis. So we're just going to pretend that labeled and unlabeled are the same in this large n limit. Okay, so the question that actually was answered way before people even thought about causal sets, much before causal sets, there was a question of enumeration of four sets. And this was work by Kleitman and Rothschild way back in the 70s, way back before the word causal set was even dreamt of, I suppose. And that was, what does a typical n-element coset look like? And if you look at, and this is basically the result, that the size of the set grows super exponentially. In particular, it has this leading order behavior that is 2 to the n squared upon 4 plus 3n upon 2 plus little o of order n subleading terms. So these typical causal sets, though, so you can say, well, that's how the whole set grows. But then what does a typical one look like? And in fact, this characterization was done by Kleitman and Rothschild. And these are the three-layer cosets, which have, you have three anti-chains, so unrelated sets of unrelated elements, the first, the second, and the third, and they're roughly populated as n upon 4, n upon 2, and n upon 4. And they have these properties that there's a certain, on an average, certain number of relations between the bottom one and the middle one, and the middle one and the top one. And every element in the bottom is related to every element on the top. But what is interesting is that the typical one, also to leading order, and that's why it sort of completely swamps out the set of all n element orders, and it goes exactly like that. So most, it's like almost everything, almost surely you're going to pick out a KR order when you pick an element causal set. And we showed that this n doesn't have to be very large. We did numerical simulations and showed that it can be as small as 100 when you start to see this KR-like behavior. They become typical. So we use Monte Carlo simulations to show that this kind of behavior is, this asymptotic regime comes about quite soon. So what's wrong about with this? And that is the thing that's difficult about this result is that when you now interpret it from the point of view of the causal set path sum, is that it's not continuum-like. And what do we mean by that? If you start to ask, can this have come from a Poisson sprinkling into a continuum spacetime? The answer is most definitely not, in some very obvious ways, but let me sort of tell you in what specific ways they're not. If you look at the number of relations, like I said, these KR cosets have a fixed number of linkage, and so you can calculate on an average what the number of relations is. And so you get this, the number of relations to look like this. And the number of relations themselves, when you look at, say, manifold-like causal sets, you have this Mirheim-Meyer continuum dimension, which you can calculate this way. This is the relation here. And what you find is that when you plug in for the dimension of the KR coset, that dimension is 2.5. The dimension is not anywhere close to an integer. It's a non-integer number. So this is another feature of being non-manifold-like. The other thing, of course, which is very obvious, is that the maximal length you have, which is related to the proper time. So if I look at a chain from here to here to here, the longest chain I have, if I count all the ends, is a three-element chain. So there's just three moments of time, and that's you know, the proper time. This is how we count proper time in manifold-like causal sets. We look at the length of the longest chain, and that tells you the proper time. So even as I increase n, all that it does is become fatter and fatter and fatter with just three moments of time. So this is not continuum-like. And finally, even if you look at these intervals I was showing you a couple of slides ago, these kinds of intervals, and I say how many of intervals of size 1, size 2, size 3, et cetera, are there, the distribution of those intervals is actually very characteristic in continuum-like causal sets. And here, I don't know if it's clear, but let me blow it up. You can see that this is in four dimensions. This is a 4D case. And there's a very clear sort of curve that comes down. So one is analytic and the dots are the simulated case. You can calculate the average interval abundance. So this is a very characteristic curve for manifold-like causal sets. And you can even read off dimension from these. But when you look at the KR cosets, then the distribution is very bizarre. You have a huge number more links. That's just the nearest neighbors. And almost none of the small ones. And then it slowly rises up and then it peaks somewhere in the middle and then does this. So the nature of the curve is basically like this, okay? So it's very different from the continuum curve. And so the distribution of intervals is also not manifold-like. Okay, so if they're not manifold-like, we have to ask the question, well, do they swamp out the action? I mean, do they swamp out the action and dominate the path integral? Because then that's not great news for us. What I would like to do is to say, well, let's look at the equivalence class of iso-action causal sets, all causal sets which have the same action. Then I collect together all the causal sets with the same action and look at the weight. And then I have a path integral with the oscillatory part and then a piece which is non-oscillatory, which is just the counting. And in that case, I can ask, well, does this entropy versus action, which one wins? And if the entropy wins, then KR cosets dominate, and we will have an obstruction to the continuum approximation of the theory, which, as I said, isn't a very good thing. What's worse is that even if they weren't, even if somehow you managed to do this, new entropy defeated the action for KR cosets, we have an entire layered hierarchy. It's like a layered cake. Causal set cake, where so you have many of these anti-chains or many of these space-like sets, all linked, and they're linked, one is below the other and they're linked. And they have a subdominant behavior, but they're still super exponential. And so the behavior goes like this. If it's a K-layered coset, then I will write it like this, where this coefficient is less than or equal to 1/4. When it's equal to 1/4, you have the KR cosets, and actually even the bilayer cosets. And D here is an ordering fraction, which is a number of relations divided by the number of possible relations. And this behavior of C is such that it, as you kind of go up, you reach this, and then it becomes monotonically decreasing afterwards. It has this very characteristic form. And basically, this means that there's a dominance, a hierarchy of dominance, with the KR cosets as the most dominant. Next are the bilayer cosets, which we will talk about a lot shortly. And then the next one is the 4-layer, then the 5-layer, and so on. And so then you have to keep, there's this huge hierarchy. And the action would then have to win over all these layered cosets. And so the question is this an obstruction to continuum, to the continuum approximation? So let's start with a small bite. And I will keep using this sort of bun because the bilayer cosets seem to be the ones that actually, and again, I apologize for this badge this year. But the bilayer posets are the simplest ones to start with. And this is what Loomis and Carlip did. They said, let's just do the simplest thing. Let's look at the simplest thing we can study. And it's a small byte to start off with the simplest case. But it turns out that that's a really significant byte that they took. So the bilayer posets are ones with just two layers. And so you can think of just the partition function as summing of the bilayers plus the rest of the posets. And so we'll just look at the contribution from the bilayer posets. And here what's really simplifying, and that's why they chose it, is that if I look at the action and I look at all of these higher, all of these intervals, the only possible interval I can have is a link, because there's nothing that I can put in between. There's no in-between layer. So I just simplify my action enormously. All I have to do then is to calculate the number of links. So I've reduced it all down to a link action. That's what I meant to show here, that everything is down to a link action. So instead of iso action, I just have iso link action. And that's much easier to now classify and quantify. So let's look at a particular, okay, so if I just looked at the maximum possible links I can have, it will happen when I, you know, when everything is linked up, everything is related. But in fact, this nmax is a bit too much. What we need is really an nmax coming from some partition, gamma and one minus gamma of the bilayer poset. And in this case, so nmax here would just be everything here is linked to everything here, right? So if I did that, then I'd get gamma into one minus gamma n squared, which would be the maximum number of possible links that I can get. So let's look at if n max is n squared upon 2, which is all elements are related one to the other, are linked one to the other, then I can parametrize the number of links that I have by p, which is just a fraction of this total possibility, where p goes from 0 to half. And so I have now a set of bilayer posets where I just look at the fixed number of links. And that for me is an iso action causal. So if I just count the number of links and I look at the number of causal sets with a fixed number of links, then I have what I had earlier, which is I've got the set of iso action things with the weight, iso action causal sets with the weight. But now further, if I look at the fact that I've now partitioned my poset, the bilayers into gamma and one minus gamma, then I can explicitly calculate the number of the number of causal sets for that partition. It's a very simple combinatorial thing that you have to do, which is basically look at the maximum number of links, which is here, which is this, as I said. And now I have this many links, and out of the maximum possible links I can have, I realize only pn squared of them. And that's the only counting I need to do. And as you can see, this quantity here is maximized when you have a bilayer poset, which is equal on the bottom and the top. What they did then was use a very clever bounding argument where when you calculate this in the large n limit to leading order, just using your Stirling approximation, you find that this, for a given filling fraction, the number of posets, the bilayer posets, goes like this. And you can use this bounding, very clever bounding argument, which basically you're saying that you take the maximizing one and then you sum over all possible partitions as well. And knowing that that this partition is also dominated by gamma equal to half, you've basically tightly bounded it, and you can use this expression for gamma equal to half to show that the counting that you wanted goes like this. where this term here is what Dhar called an entropy function, which appeared ubiquitously in many of these calculations. So when you put all of this back into the bilayer partition function, then you basically get, you add in this counting and you exponentiate it and you get a form of this kind. So what they showed is that when you then do a saddle point approximation of this in the large n limit, you do a saddle point approximation, you find that, you know, you pick the right contour and so on and so forth, you find that there's a suppression of these bilayer cosets whenever you have this particular parameter space being satisfied, which means that L, and in for D equal to 4 in particular, the discreteness scale is sort of order, has to be at least of order Planck scale, if not larger. Okay, so that's a parameter range in which things work out well. So in other words, bilayer coset is suppressed. So of course, the next question is, because the KR ones are the dominant ones, the three-layer ones are the dominant ones, you want to know, well, does this analysis extend? And so then we took the next byte. So again, the byte, because we still use the bilayer poset example in some very crucial way. And in particular, we said, well, we can't really look for isocausal posets. It's just too hard a question, too hard a combinatorial question to count isoaction causal sets. So let's just instead again do the link counting. It's not the right action, but let's do it. And let's see what we find when we look at all possible layers. And what we found is that, so for a K-layer poset, should have been a capital K. So you have gamma 1 to gamma K, where sum over gamma is equal to 1. And this is just your filling fraction. And here you see that the maximum number of links that you have given a filling fraction is going to be given in a very simple way, just by looking at the number of possible, all possible linkages between subsequent layers. If you did that, you would maximize the number of links. And so now you're looking at a fraction of that maximum possible links. And when you count that, you get something very similar. You basically look at the set of all possible, for a given filling fraction, the set of all possible causal sets, K-layer causal sets, which have Pn squared number of links. Okay, so that's the counting that we want to do. And it turns out that you can actually, by some slightly more sophisticated counting argument, also use the similar bounds to contain, to obtain this here, which is what we want. So in other words, this is a set of all possible K-layer posets with Pn squared number of links with the same action, because we're using the link action. And surprise of surprises, and this is where the buy sort of seems to come all the way, even across the K-layer posets, we still come back to the same expression. And I think when my student said, oh, it's going to give you the same thing, I said, no, that can't be true. And so we tried really hard to see whether we'd made a mistake somewhere, but it turns out that in fact, it's exactly the same expression for the partition function that you get in the bilayer poset. So the saddle point approximation, everything is just sort of carries over. You didn't have to do any hard work in that case. So what this tells you is that if you use the link action, then the link action suppresses all the K-layer orders as well in this parameter regime. Okay. But of course, this is just the link action. So one has to worry that this isn't the full Einstein-Hilbert action. So maybe the Einstein-Hilbert action, if you look at, it's going to, you know, give you more complications. And this is where we were at for some time until Steve and I started to talk about it. And then Peter as well got involved in this. And we started to say, well, maybe the combinatorics is actually not so difficult after all. And it gives you something that's, again, your last bite with the BDG action, because again, you'll see why does bilayer sort of the original simplest calculation, the first bite, in fact, sort of permeates down to the very last bite, so to speak. So if we had to do this so just to sort of refresh your memory, in the BDG action, we have all of these possible intervals that we'd have to count. So we'd have to look at causal sets with, you know, the same action, and we'd have to count how many of these other types of intervals there are. And how do we do that was sort of the question, and which we were stuck at for a while. But there's already indication, and as you, if you recall, we showed you this graph here of how the intervals behave. And so although there's a lot of links, the first few set of intervals, basically there's not any of them. And then it slowly grows up to some maximum and then it goes down. So this maximum happens at nj, where j is fairly large. J is around 12 here. And so it happens at a much larger j than the ones that appear in the action. So this is already sort of numerical evidence. All of this is sort of numerical evidence that we had that the lower n, the n1, the n2, the n3, etc., don't really seem to feature much. So can we actually, so the question is, can we, from going from these numerical suggestions that maybe the link action was enough, can we actually prove it combinatorially? And that's what we did. And so in the remaining bit of my talk, I'll tell you a little bit about this. Again, please stop me for any questions. I decided to go a little bit more technical than my usual causal set talks, partly because I felt like people know enough about causal sets of PI, hopefully. All right, so, and all of this is just really simple combinatorics, so it's not very, it's easy enough to follow. So let's try to see how to count the number of NI intervals for KR orders when I is greater than zero, so things that are not links. So I should actually write it as the probability. I should, and this is my mistake. Let me try to rectify this and call this a probability of a link. Okay, and this is also probability of a link from L1 to L2, that's P, and the probability of link from L2 to L3, that's Q. So now we're just doing counting, and we want to be able to just use the counting measure, which is just count the number of causal sets with a certain property and divide over all the possible causal sets. And that gives you probabilities. And so this is what we're going to do. What we're going to also do is to use a link matrix. So we have linkages here. And because of transitivity, we know that if EI is linked to EJ, and EJ is linked to EK, then EI is related to EK. This link is the most fundamental relation you have. It's the nearest neighbor relation. So the link matrix actually contains everything you need. It has all the information about the causal set. And because we're layering things in this way, that is L1, L2, L3, it's ordered. We're using a particular choice of labeling. The link matrix has this form of being upper off diagonal. And we say that Lij is one if and only if there's a link between Ei and Ej. Otherwise, it's zero. So there's just a bunch of zeros and ones, which are the link matrix. Now, when I take the link matrix squared, I square the link matrix, what do I get? When I square the link matrix, I find that this L squared of ij, if I expand it, then what does this do? It says that the probability that there's a link that from I to K and from K to J, right? And there are so many terms like this. And if this sum is equal to R, then that tells me that there's an R element interval, this is R, between EI and EJ. So this LI squared, L squared IJ is equal to some integer, and that integer is the size of the interval between EI and EJ. Okay, so here I've drawn, this should have also been red. For some reason, it's stopping red. Let me color it red. So you have between EI and EJ, you just have these four elements, and that interval can be obtained just by taking the square of the link action for KR cosets, okay? Because there's only one layer in between. Of course, if you took the EI and EJ here, EI and EJ here, then the square would give you zero, because you can see that in this corner here, that's, you basically get a zero because you only have a link. You don't have an n-element interval, right? So the link matrix becomes a very useful tool. So like I said, we want to define a probability that a causal set has a property C by counting the number of causal sets with property B, and dividing over all possible causal sets in that class, right? So the probability then, so we're counting now just probabilities for a particular EI in layer one and a particular EJ in layer three to have an n element, a j element interval between them, a j element, the interval has j elements in between in layer two, is therefore given by a very simple combinatorial expression like this, where I basically say, well, the probability for this to be linked to this is P, the probability for this to be linked to this is Q, okay? And so, the fact that I have so many things here means that I have those J objects here are realized. So in this case, three. And the rest of the possibilities are not realized. And so there's gamma to N minus J that are not realized. Okay, so it's a very simple combinatorial expression. And the probability, therefore, for you to get R number of J intervals is given by this expression. In the asymptotic limit, what you find, and this is for large N, that you find that this is highly suppressed. This is the expression you should look at, which is that, this is the expression to look at, which is that this goes like 2 to the minus n squared times some constants, which depend on the details. So it's suppressed by minus n squared, and that's just to have nj equal to something times n. Remembering that the number of links goes like n squared, you would want the other intervals to at least contribute n squared, otherwise they'd be subleading. But as you start to then increase, you say, well, let me look at, you know, even so, let me look at something that's order n squared, then it's suppressed like n cubed. So in other words, the number of intervals you get in the action is going to be highly suppressed to the order that we're interested, to leading order. So essentially, this is sort of our result. And you see that the contribution of any j that's greater than zero, as long as j, so I should write j is much, much less than, j is much, much less than n, because of course, if you have too many layers and you just have one element per layer, then you get a chain. And we're not talking about such things, we're just talking about things that are relatively squat. And so what this tells you then, so all of these contributions are subleading, and it tells you that the link action is in fact enough. And what this then we conclude, is that the discrete Einstein-Hilbert action in any dimension, and this is actually an important point that I should highlight. So in any dimension, suppresses all K-layer orders. And why do I say in any dimension? It's because in any dimension, the action, so if I come back to this action, these lambda j's are dimension dependent. And the leading order is always n0 plus these other terms. And the other terms are all suppressed. So in any dimension, the lambda, you know, it doesn't matter what the lambda j's are. So in other words, what our result says is that the K layer orders are suppressed for any choice of dimension of the BDG action. In other words, action wins over entropy. All right, so of course, so that sort of brings me towards the end of my talk. And the question is, what does the action favor? So we've said that this whole set, so I think we've basically through these three bytes, which are all leading back to the same. So in one case, the K-layered case, we had the fact that the saddle point approximation looks the same as a bilayer case. And the fact that the link action, which was also used in the bilayer case, is also the right action to use to leading order. So all of this goes back to the original calculation. There's much in it that's actually robust and which is leaks into all of these other calculations. So once we do that, we know, okay, all of these very dominant posets are not contributing, but we have a more important question to ask, the next important question to ask, which is, what does the action favor? And the important thing in causal sets is that we're not putting in a dimension by hand. I mean, sometimes we do when we do certain Monte Carlo simulations, because you know, life is easier that way, but there isn't a natural space-time dimension to assign to a causal set. I mean, we want to include things that don't look like manifolds. These definitely didn't, but they were so dominant that they would have swamped out everything. And so the fact that they're not going to be dominant is a good thing. But in a generic, in a causal set, the dimension is not, I mean, you can define it, but it isn't going to be integer-like. And restricting that is not very clear whether that's too much of a restriction. So all possible dimensions are included in the n-element causal sets. As n becomes larger and larger, this is more and more likely that you get all more and more dimensions at some given density of sprinkling. And the question is, why does d equal to 4 spacetime emerge? And does the d-dimensional discrete Einstein-Hilbert action suppress things that are not the dimension of our real, of our world? So these are, of course, difficult questions. And all I will say then is that, and this I think Bianca might remember from my from the last time we met, it's sort of an idea that has yet to be fleshed out carefully, which I thought I'd put out there, which is to just look at continuum-like contributions and ask, well, I mean, what if the continuum-like contributions are also suppressed and where? That's not a good thing at all, because that means somehow that we're, you know, although we've suppressed the bad guys, we've also suppressed the good ones. What tells us that the good ones are not suppressed? And one way of doing this is to basically do a sort of mean field calculation where we know that given a causal set ensemble corresponding to a particular continuum spacetime, there are fluctuations in the action. And if I look at the mean of the action, the mean of the action is given by the continuum action. But the fluctuations for each realization has a different fluctuation. So now if I consider this kind of mean field approximation or mean field approach, then of course in the limit, these fluctuations are going to infinity, the fluctuations I have, but for any finite n, they're there. And I can then sum over, when I sum over all possible causal sets, which are in this class of, you know, come from sprinklings, then I really effectively only have to sum over the fluctuations. I only have the fluctuations entering into the e to the is. And then I have to ask, well, for a given, so I do the same thing that I did earlier, which is to say, let me look at ISO action, and now I want to do ISO fluctuation causal sets. How many causal sets are there for this particular fluctuation of delta S? And that is possibly just a Gaussian, and it's, you know, there's indications that what you're going to do, you get some kind of Gaussian. But of course, the devil is in the details, and this is why this is not an exact result in any sense. If you did this and you said, well, the fluctuations go like this and you normalize it carefully, then you find that this is a very simple integral to solve, or known integral, I should say. And it has this particular form. And if those fluctuations, and there's reason to imagine that those fluctuations are ones in which as n becomes larger and larger, this one upon, you know, that the relative widths go down as you get, you peak better and better as you get to larger and larger n, that your fluctuations, relative fluctuations become smaller, then it looks like what you get is something that's actually finite. What's also interesting is that if you use the wrong action for this wrong dimensional action for this space-time, for this ensemble. So in other words, you've got an ensemble coming from dimension D, but if you use the action of dimension D prime, then you can't do this mean field because the action will not average out to something like this. And in fact, we've calculated these things in another context, and you can see that the number of that the action will basically grow, and it looks, at least preliminary results suggest, that what you'll get is something that's highly oscillatory. In other words, you'll get something that's not one of those, you know, it's not going to peak, but it's going to be oscillatory, that will dominate the path integral. So a hopeful statement was that space-like causal set might just have a fighting chance. I really need to do this calculation before claiming anything more carefully. So here are the open questions. I think I have enough time to just go over them. I think that there are these very important questions. How do they emerge dynamically? I mean, there are state sum models in which we can construct a dynamics in which the continuum emerges in a particular, in a particular phase, but we want to ask whether it can do so even in this Lorentzian context. Can we calculate expectation values from this partition function of interesting observables like the dimension, for example, the number of relations? Can you do this also in the double path integral formulation and other more speculative questions? And of course, at the end of it, you really have to ask interpretation questions. What does this really mean in terms of observables of the theory and so on? So let me end there and thank you all for this.
Thank you so much for your talk. Is there is any question from student first? No, a student. So Bianca, you have a question? Go for it.
Yes, Omoti. Can you say something more to a point which you had maybe in the first third of your argument, which is actually, I think that was Khaled's and Lomi's saddle point approximation.
Mm-hmm.
So is the suppression happening because, first I think it's, so it's a quadratic action and no. So the variable is in P. No. So
the variable is P.
Is P and it's linear in P, or is
yes.
it no?
It's linear in P. It's not linear in P because you have this Dhar entropy function H of two.
That's a function. Yeah, that's a function. Okay.
That's a complicated function where it's got it's an entropy kind of function. Yeah.
Okay, and I guess my question is there only one saddle point, and do you have a more intuitive understanding what the mechanism for suppression is? Is it that the action is just highly oscillating everywhere, and that's the reason why everything averages out to zero? And is there only one saddle point, and is
So you can, if you chose a contour upwards, you don't get a suppression. So, there is a, so you're looking at the least action. You're looking at the stationary point. So the, I'm hearing a lot of echoing. So,
okay, we cut so can the microphone when you speak, and we will switch on back.
Okay. All right. Yeah. So, So, it's basically yes. This is a saddle point, but it is also the one that you have to pick the one where you get the least contribute, or the, what is it called, the what's the oscillatory part of this called, the stationary phase approximation. So the stationary phase approximation, this is what you need to do. If you pick the other one, it's not the right saddle point. So if you go to the if you choose a contour to go up, then this one you don't get a stationary point. So it seems like it's the only one, but more broadly, it is a very simple, at some level, a very simple integral. And the fact that it's all reduced down to this one simple integral has to do with the fact that one is literally, just counting links, and you've managed to find an expression. So the difficult part, at some level, the difficult part is to find this, expression here, which is accounting. So the fact that there is this, this non-oscillatory part that's competing with the oscillatory part. It's not purely oscillatory at all, right? So that's sort of key. And because of that, you have, but I don't know if I have a, you know, deeper understanding of why this happens, but I mean.
Okay, but it's only linear in P.
Yes. No, it's not linear.
The oscillatory part is linear in P. Okay.
Right, exactly.
I mean, it's kind of Fourier transform of exponential h2 pi form, no? It's almost like a Fourier transform. Of the function which is exponential h of 2 pi.
You're saying that
I do understand that it averages out to zero because there is possibly a stationary point, but maybe the stationary point is in the complex plane somewhere. And
So this is sort of what you have, right? I mean. Just to be very explicit about the oscillatory part and the counting part, right?
Yeah. And so I'm kind of asking, is there possibly a kind of a fast intuitive argument why that is suppressed?
I don't have an intuitive sense of this subtle point approximation, meaning it just seems very straightforward. So I don't know if I, and it is true that since it appears everywhere, it appears in all the, even in the K-layer case. I don't have anything more profound to say about it. I mean, but it's something I'll think about. I'll try to see if, I mean, I haven't actually thought to question what looked very obvious, but I think what you're asking is, is there sort of a parameter, something here that if you changed, you would stop having this effect. So one thing that we did check, because we were wondering whether, because you know, you sum over things where you're basically taking the integral, so you've taken a sum, you made it into an integral, from zero to p, going from zero to a half, okay, or, you know, in this case. So, well, I mean, if you look, think about p equal to zero for, say, a bi-Lyapunov set, that means that there's no probability for these two to be linked, which is essentially that they're both actually just in the same single layer, okay? And so you'd imagine that doesn't have any entropy associated to it. So let's just look at the parts that are highly linked, which are the ones that are contributing entropy. So we tried to do this integral for larger p values. And it's essentially very funny, but it's just not, we found that you can't do a similar kind of saddle point approximation for that at all. So it sort of seems very important. And this is kind of maybe going where you're going, which is that you need to include this entire set so they all contribute in this way. Even things that you think are not entropically important seem to be important in this calculation. So that's the one lesson we learned. But I don't know if there's anything more profound there. So
okay, thank you. Thanks for the nice talk.
Yeah, if there is a last question, we can take it.
I'd like to ask a question.
Yeah, go for it.
Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Great, thank you. Hi, Sumati. I have a very general question, actually, about causal sets and how it relates to what everything you spoke about, which is I've always wondered whether if you just consider the link as the basic entity in a concept of causal sets, rather than the point, you know, is that equivalent? And I think I learned in the past from somebody that at the level of just the sets, specifying the possible sets, it's a kind of dual description and it's completely equivalent. But the actions you're talking about, if I understand right, which I very well might not, are sort of based on the concept of the causal set as a collection of points with relations.
Mm-hmm.
So what I'm asking is, if you reformulate, if you use the link formulation of what a causal set is, where the elementary entity is the link, would that change anything about all everything you're considering, the possible actions you could write and you know, which link posets dominate, et cetera?
Okay, so that's the, that, I mean, what you said earlier is true, that you can think about things entirely in terms of links, but then we also have to think about, I mean, it's not just a collection of links, it's obviously links which also intersect. Those intersection points, so you can, like you said, you can think of it as a dual description, but the intersection points will be the elements that we have, just as the relations are, you know, the on the set of elements, you have the relations or the links. But
yeah,
if you have just links,
the incidence relation of the links would tell you what the ordering relation is.
Points. Right. But then you also, from the links, you would also get out the points themselves. So it's really has to be fully dual, because otherwise, you'll just have a collection of links and you'll have no connectivity between the links. But if I have two links which have a joint, you know, have a V kind of a structure, then that intersection of the link at a point will define the point, so to speak, right? So I would need to have. But yeah, so it's interesting what you're saying, because you know, we start off with a ground set, which is N as a number of elements. And then the number of links there grows like N squared in this particular case. What you're asking is, if we started off with just the link set and asked, tried to formulate an action, is that the kind of thing you're saying?
Yes. I'm asking, is your action like instantly translatable into the link language, or is it really a different kind of action than you could write in terms of the links? Also, I think you're at the beginning, you said you're working with labeled posets, but you know, for large N, that's probably not getting things wrong statistically. But that issue might be different if you're working with linked posets as the fundamental object also. So I just wonder in general, and I guess I should tell you that what's behind my question, just for mm-hmm. It's just that I've always felt that posets are, while they're fascinating and very alluring, my guess would be there's just not enough structure in them to actually somehow give rise to space-time. Maybe they don't need much more though. And so I kind of think of a link as something I could attach some algebraic structure to, like a spinner or some quantum mm-hmm. transition. Like the elementary thing would be the transition, not the point. And anyway, that's just sort of philosophy that's behind why I'm asking this question.
Right, so I think that those relations are in fact the causal set. I mean, you have a ground set along with relations. So the relations, without those relations or without the links, like I said, the links give you all the relations through transitivity. So let's just stick to links. Without the links, you have no causal set. So there is that. And you know, even when you construct propagators, a causal, you know, scalar field propagator on the causal set, you use links. If you want any geometric information, it's all about the links. I mean, even here you can see that, you know, the intervals, how many links there are, you need to count the number of links or things that you obtain from the links. So I think that the links are very essential to the way we do things, but I think you're asking for something a bit more sophisticated, which is, or more difficult, which is to sort of think of the dual description like you would think of, instead of edges and vertices, think of vertices or vertices and edges, think of the edges and then the vertices. Is that sort of where you're going with this?
Yes. And I mean, if you maybe point to your action, like, is every term in the action something that's naturally writable purely in terms of the links, or is it, in what way does it refer to the points? And would there be a different kind of natural action if you formulated things in terms of the links?
Right. So in fact, you can generate any, you can, so the link action, like I said, is just, you know, all the possible linking relations that you have, zero or one. Now, you can actually construct from, you know, if you have this interval here with, which has a particular structure, say that, you know, it's a, the interior structure is of this sort, then you can, through a rather complicated mechanism, you can use a link, the link matrix to extract out this interval. So you say this number, so just to say that once again in a slightly clearer way, if I take the link matrix and I take L squared, then I have all objects which have something in between. But then if I have L squared ij equal to r, and this is something I already talked about, that'll give you the number of objects in between. So the link matrix can be used in this way. And so I think that in at some level, you can use the link matrix much more extensively than perhaps we do in the way we write it down here. But it would require, it looks much more complicated than this way of writing it, because you have to say, this is linked, but not that, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of, you might have to stick in some delta functions in there to say, these things can't happen, and so on. But I think, in fact, Astrid might have done some work on this, trying to construct a link action, the action entirely in terms of links.
Is that in a published paper?
I think so. Yes. It is. It's something that came out in 2017, if I'm not mistaken. So, and you know, where she basically looked at, her point was to look at higher derivative things, and then to try to see whether we can think entirely in terms of the link action. So, but it does look a lot messier than this way of writing it, but. I mean, maybe that's not, yeah.
Right. Okay, thank you.
Thanks for the question.
Thank you very much for the question. We are starting to be a bit over time, so I think we should all thank Sumaili for her talk. Thank you very much. And if people want to ask more questions, I think you can do that afterward, I think. So, yeah, thank you very much. And, yeah, see you all next week then.
Thank you so much. Thanks. See you, Lee.
Yes. Yes. I have a paper coming out that will surprise you. Let me just.
Okay. That sounds. I look forward to that.
But you may see where it's just wrong. In which case, please tell me.
Is it on these energetic causal sets?
It's on, yes, but also your kind of causal sets.
Oh, okay. Well, very nice.
Okay.
Oh, really looking forward to that. Yeah.
We'll see if you like it when you see it.
Well, I mean, it's like has little to do. I mean, it's more, I'm sure that, yeah. Okay, good. All right. I look forward to that. Are you going to be giving a talk on it, or I mean, I'm not following any of the PI talks. I sort of kind of switched off Zoom pretty much. But if are you planning to give a talk on it soon?
Somebody will ask me.
Someone asks you, okay.
Well, somebody has.
We should get you on our causal set. We have this causal set virtual seminar thing that started during the pandemic.
Okay.
And, I mean, it's, yeah, and so we should get you on that. That would be really nice. So,
can I just watch it? Is it?
Yeah. I mean, anyone, I can send you a link to that and put you on the mailing list. We just keep adding to the mailing list, and it's not been very frequent, but it's definitely there. And Stab just gave a talk class yesterday evening. I mean, mm-hmm. Evening for my time, but we'd be very happy. I don't know if you know Aitan Bachmat. He's a computer scientist who's also very interested in causal set. So he is a regular to the meetings, and he's going to give a talk. He's offered to give a talk, I think, sometime in maybe April or June. I can't remember. Yeah.
Okay.
So,
so see you there.
I'll definitely add you. Yeah. So I'll definitely add you to the list.
Okay. Well, bye for now. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks so much, Lee. Thank you. Okay. Bye-bye.